Hey, welcome back to Good Growing with the Garden Gal. I'm George Corliss.
I'm Jelaine Fenner.
And today we've got the Garden Gal herself with us, Teresa Williams, and we're talking about designing your vegetable garden, and everybody should be right about at that point, or maybe even a little bit past that point, huh, Teresa, right now?
Well, you know, in our county, a lot of people traditionally put their garden in Memorial Day weekends, and we're not quite there yet. We're almost there.
Now, when we're talking about preparing, you know, your soil and for water and sunshine, where you're going to put your garden and other things like that, how do you go about planting these? Let's say you're going to plant in rows. Let's say we're going to choose that. Do you plant them east-west? Do you plant them north or south? Or does it matter?
The only time when it would really matter is if you've got tall crops and short crops that you're going to be putting into your garden. You'd want to put your tall crops on the north end of the garden so that they don't shade the shorter crops. But other than that, east, west, north, south doesn't really matter one way or the other.
And what about predominant winds? Like a lot of times it seems like in the summer it comes out of the south, southwest, or the west here where we're at. But does that matter at all?
It matters from just a bit from the point of some of our garden plants are subject to fungal diseases, and if you have it so that they get nice amounts of wind, then that can dry the plant surfaces off more quickly and help reduce your problems with fungal diseases. But that being said, you don't want them to be damaged by a lot of harsh winds either. For instance, if you have a harsh wind, it can stunt the plant and you don't get as good of yield. It's awfully difficult to control the wind. It wouldn't be a good idea to put the garden where there was no air movement, because you're just going to invite diseases. So you want a bit of air movement if you can, but not wind blasting.
Is there anything that's predominant as far as species of insects and other things like that that are, you know, the plants are really struggling with around, you know, Michigan right at the moment?
Ooh, it's a bit early for most of our insect development. One of the earliest insect problems I see is flea beetles. That can get your early crops. And they make little tiny holes in the leaves of your plants, particularly things in the cabbage, broccoli, radish family. It's called the brassicas. They particularly like those plants. But this time of year, this early, really it's just the flea beetles that I see.
So depending on where people actually plant their gardens, though, can they detract bugs from wanting to come to their garden, or can they attract bugs from coming to their garden?
The short answer is if you have a healthy plant, they're less attractive to bugs. So the healthier you can, the better soil and water management that you do, the healthier the plants are, that plant is less attractive to bugs.
Because I remember David, our general manager here, they didn't even plant last year, and they have a huge garden.
I would think
probably about the size of yours. Had problems with potato beetles, just infiltrating everything in the garden. And so I think what they did, they didn't even plant last year, and they're planting this year, hoping that...
But not potatoes.
Oh, yeah, but not potatoes.
You're not going to plant potatoes this year.
But it didn't seem to matter. The bugs seemed to like the tomatoes, and they seemed to like pretty much anything in their garden. So is there anything you can do to deal with things like that?
Like to a massive infestation?
Correct.
Once you have them? Potato beetles are really difficult to kill once they're mature and they are a beetle. They've got that hard outer shell that we call an exoskeleton, and it's really tough to kill them. You can, but the product that you would use would be very, very potent. And I like, there's a few things you can do in general for potato beetles. Is if you can keep the soil moisture fairly consistent, that makes a plant that's less attractive to a potato beetle. And a lot of times by putting on a straw mulch that's, say, about 8 inches deep, that can be very helpful. One of the things that we do is... we rotate where we grow potatoes. And then the field that we grew potatoes in last year always seems to have a few volunteers. In other words, some potato plants that come up that I didn't plant this year, just little baby potatoes that we missed harvesting the year before. Those can be what we call a trap crop or your scout crop. You can go let those little potatoes in the from last year grow and look there first for signs of the potatoes beetles coming out from their overwintering cycle or laying their eggs on those little plants. So you can try and get those first. And then a little later in the season, you won't get them all, but you'll be able to control a lot of them that way. You'll start seeing, they start out as little black-brown specks on your plants and gradually grow bigger into this soft-bodied larva that is the early stages of potato building or potato beetle. They're fairly easy to control at that stage of life. You can pick them off and drop them into just a jar of water with a little vegetable oil on top of it. Or there are some organic pesticides such as spinosad or BT that can be sprayed when they're on the larva stage and will kill them. And they're pretty darn safe, registered for use in organic agriculture. But once they get to that beetle point, then it's tough.
And so when we're planning to you know, where we're going to put our vegetable garden at, around here especially, out in the country, you'll notice fences that are completely surrounding vegetable gardens now because of the deer for the most part. Mm-hmm. How high does a fence have to be to keep a deer out of the vegetable garden?
Deer, it depends a bit on how hungry they are, but if really 8-foot tall woven wire fence to keep a deer out.
I was going to say, you know, vegetable farmers from down by Ludington and Hart, they've moved up here for more land. Mm-hmm. And that's what they have to have, at least 8-foot high, you know, because they contract with, you know, like Gerber and some of the other vegetable companies. And they tell them, and it has to, yeah, the fence has to be 8-foot high.
There's another option, too. Instead of one 8-foot high fence, you could put up two fences that were 4-foot high that are about 3 or 4 feet apart from each other, because deer are very good at height, but they're not very good at distance, and they don't like that. And the other thing that I've seen is a fence that is slanted, so the fence is wider or about as wide as it is tall. They basically take a fence and kind of lay it down at a 45-degree angle. That will also stop deer.
Really?
It will. And another option, if you don't want to do fencing, there are products out there that are made from dried animal blood, and you can spray them on your growing plants, and anything that's sprayed with that will be unpalatable to the deer. So that's the cheap way. But you have to spray about once a week because all that new vegetation, you've got to keep covered with the product. So it takes, you know, more frequent doing, but it's much less expensive to use a product like that than it is to put up an 8-foot tall fence.
Now, a lot of the garden growers from probably Cadillac northward, I know I've had some friends that have done that with the blood balls and some other things like that, mm-hmm. and they've attracted bear.
Okay.
So there are a few if, ands, and buts, I guess, about okay. anything, like you're saying. You know, you got clay soil and you got sandy soil and in between. And so the same thing with these protective ways to be able to keep your garden there growing instead of in an animal's belly, you know, mm-hmm. and just kind of going out like that. Now, what about planning for drought, Teresa?
If we have sandy soils up here, and drought's a big concern. If you don't irrigate up here, you're not going to have a garden. It's that simple. But there's ways you can help in addition to make your water go further. If you increase the organic matter in your soil, like through compost or through in the fall, maybe working in a few chopped leaves, that can act as a sponge and as a reservoir for water. So that way you can do longer between watering periods, and like you can go on vacation and not have your garden die on you. Another option is to put down a mulch after your plants are up and germinated. That can help conserve soil moisture so that the water isn't just evaporating from the soil surface. And plus putting in your irrigation system.
Now, you mentioned a mulch. Give us some mm-hmm. ideas.
If you have grass clippings and you haven't put a weed and feed product on the grass, that's a great mulch. Chopped leaves, oat straw, those are all good. In some places, I've known people to try wood chips, but those are not meant to be tilled into the soil.
Right.
It's pretty important that you don't till the wood chips into the soil. You leave them just on the surface. Some people there's a biodegradable paper mulch that I've seen. I've tried that, and it does work. There are some people who use plastic mulches too.
Plastic mulches?
Yes, they keep in the soil and keep out weeds both.
Wow. I noticed over in the McBain area, some of the Amish especially use black plastic once the plants get out of the ground. They're kind of cut out for the plants. And then is that work or is that a big hassle or...
Well, it does work in terms of it warms the soil a bit. It helps keep the soil moisture in the soil and not evaporate out. And it does control weeds. But at the end of the season, you do have this issue of what do you do with all that plastic?
You can't, for the most part, rip it up and then reuse it again.
It depends on the plastic, if it's been treated to be UV stabilized. If it's been treated to be stabilized, sunlight stabilized, then you probably could. If it hasn't been treated to be stabilized, then you probably can't.
What do you use at the farm?
We use our grass clippings, chopped leaves, straw. My favorite is we have fields that we dedicate for growing clover and alfalfa, and we mow them and catch the clippings, and that's my favorite mulch because those are pretty high nitrogen content, the clippings of clover and alfalfa. That's my favorite mulch.
What about like in the fall where you see all around these towns these bags from, you know, some of the bigger box stores where people are putting their leaves and the other things like that in there? Can you just go around with a pickup truck and ask the people if you can have that? I mean, does that make good mulch over the course of time? Or
I would ask the people what specifically is in that bag because, you know, it's kind of like a wild card. You don't know what you're going to get. So I would, if you know the person and you know what they put in the bag, then it could be, but I'd want to know.
And most of the time, let's just say it's leaves. I mean, would that be great mulch like that?
Yeah, if you chop them. If you don't chop the leaves, they'll basically mat down and be almost impervious. So you have to chop them up first.
And how do you go about chopping them?
Put them in a pile and run your lawnmower over them.
Okay.
Or you can put it through a shredder.
I didn't think of that. That would work out really well. Hey, I'm George Corliss. Jelaine Fender's here with me, and you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Gal, and that's Teresa Williams. And we're talking about designing your vegetable garden today. And Teresa, what about crop rotation as you're designing your vegetable garden? How important is that?
If you can do it, it makes a big difference in terms of making good use of the various nutrients in your soil and for helping with disease suppression. We have some of our plant diseases overwinter in the soil. And most plant diseases are pretty specific as to which crop families they will affect. For instance, something that will affect plants in the cabbage family isn't likely to affect something in the carrot family. So if you have enough space in your garden, you can plan that, okay, if this year I've got broccoli, next year I could do carrots, the next year you could do tomatoes, and maybe the next year lettuce. And some of those are root crops, some of those are seed crops, some of those are leafy crops. And so they all need a slightly different set of nutrients. So you're sort of rotating through, well, which nutrients do I need this year? And you're also rotating through not overwintering any diseases because they don't have the same plant from one year to another.
So it's always best every year to rotate the crops.
If you can. Now, some folks, their garden is small enough where they just really don't have that option. If it's a 10 by 4 foot plot,
you're not going to rotate a whole lot.
No, you're not. So, but if you have a bigger garden, it's a good idea to practice rotation. And we like to see at least 4 years between the same crop family.
Mm. 4 years?
4 years, yeah.
Wow. I noticed we lived in southern Illinois, but I noticed that they've been doing this type of crop rotation up here now, is that they would plant corn 1 year and then soybeans the next year. Mm-hmm. And one robs the soil of one thing and the other puts that back in the soil for the next year. Is that correct, how that kind of works?
In terms of putting things back, the only thing that could really be put back would be nitrogen because the soybeans are a legume and legumes can take atmospheric nitrogen, nitrogen from the air. It's actually the air in the soil. And then convert it into a form that plants can use. So it's there and gives a slight boost to the corn crop, a little bit of nitrogen for the corn crop the next year.
Okay, what are some other things they could rotate besides corn and soybeans?
They might be interested in growing a small grain like wheat or oats. perhaps a hay crop, but usually hay crops are only grown where there's a dairy, you know, where there's dairy regions or where there's a lot of horses or other livestock that would need hay.
For silage as it goes through there.
Okay. So, Teresa, is there something that we should consider in laying out the garden to help control the insects?
One of my favorite ways to help control insects is to just not give them access to the plants. And there's a product available now, the broad category is floating row covers. And they're ultra thin layers of fabric designed to be used in agriculture. And if you put those over top of the crops and bury the edges, the insects can't get to them. And so they can't harm your crops. So when you think
of... Wait a minute. They're called what?
Floating row cover.
And what are they made out of?
Spun bond polyester. And depending, you can get them in all different kinds of thicknesses.
Have you heard of that, Julie?
So it kind of looks like a screen. Is that what
no,
I'm thinking?
No, no, because screens are woven. This is just more like filaments that have been pressed together.
Because when you said that, I mean, something came to mind, and I just thought of kind of like a screen. They're, you know, real thin.
There are, I'm aware of one product called TechNet that is like a screen. That's considerably pricier, but it is very effective as well.
So does it come in like a roll?
Yeah, it comes in a roll.
By how big?
There's lots of different widths out there. The minimum that I've seen is 5 feet. We tend to buy rolls that are 10 feet wide. Most of the time, you have to buy it through a catalog. I haven't seen it very often in a retail store.
How expensive, pricey?
The thicker you get, the pricier it is. And I'm trying to think what it was the last time I purchased it. We purchased it in 1,000-foot rolls. And then
it lasts a while.
It does. But we worked with a group of folks here at the Wexford Conservation District. We knew people were interested in it. So we had a meeting where folks who were interested got together and people talked about what they wanted. And they went together and placed a group order so they could get that discount of buying it in a roll. But you can also, through a lot of the seed catalogs, already get a cut to length. And the price varies so much. I'd really hate to try and quote it. It's a little pricier than a garden spray, but you don't have to spray anything. And depending on the thickness, the ultra-thin stuff usually lasts one season. The thicker stuff can last 2 to 3 seasons.
So is it you've planted your garden, and then you lay it down?
Then you lay it down.
Do you lay it right after you plant it, or you wait until you can see some little sprouts coming up?
I like to lay it when I plant it, and what I do is I put hoops into the ground so that this floating row cover fabric is suspended over the hoops and not flat on the plant. Okay. So there's a little bit of air space between it. And you can leave it on there until, if you've got a plant that blooms like a cucumber, you want to take that cover off at bloom time so that the plants can get pollinated. Although there are options nowadays for particular types of plants called parthenocarpic varieties that don't need insect pollination. They'll just grow the fruit themselves. So you could actually leave it on the whole season if you wanted.
Wow.
But it's great for squash bugs. You know, all my squash I put under this floating row cover, and I don't have any problem with managing squash bugs that way.
What about frost? Does that help?
It does. And we have two different things we do with the frost. We can take that same insect cover and maybe put 2 or 3 layers of it, use some of the older stuff that might have a slight tear in it, so it's not good for insect protection anymore, but we keep it around for a couple seasons, use it to protect plants from frost.
And what is it called again?
Floating row cover. And there's several different manufacturers, and they make them different widths, different lengths, different weights.
Do you make your... What did you, it wasn't a trellis. What did you?
Hoops.
You make your hoops out of PVC pipe, or what do you do?
You can use just number 9 wire if it's a fairly narrow row. If you want to do a bed that's wider, you might use PVC.
Interesting.
We do both.
Interesting. Well, it's time for our second break, folks. But you want to stick around. We're going to ask some more questions about this floating row cover. That really intrigued me. I hope it did you too. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.